ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the Gold Coast of Tasmania. We live in the very best place in Australia, trust me. But the problem with that is we bring so many people here who actually want to make it their home.
Coastal communities around the country are dealing with increasing pressure from the popular sea change. For some residents of Tasmania's east coast, it's either leave the region or risk being homeless as they grapple with a scarcity of long-term rentals. We'll have that story soon. We'll also meet a 71-year-old pensioner who had to do something she hadn't done since her teenage years to avoid being homeless. She became a flatmate.
I thought, that's ridiculous. I scoffed at it. I haven't lived with anyone since my husband's passing. Where are they going to stay in my two-bedroom unit? But it dawned on me that this might be the solution. It was a viable solution.
I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide. Often sun-drenched, friendly locals, no shortage of views to eat your fish and chips from, moving to a coastal area might seem ideal. But Tasmania's Breakaday region is struggling to house its growing population. It also has an ageing population, and some are concerned that as it continues growing older, the housing squeeze will mean locals won't be able to age in place. Our reporter Bec Pridham travelled to Tasmania's east coast.
Either this or you want to hold them?
Yeah, I'll hold them.
And down these here.
In a sun-drenched backyard in the seaside town of St Helens, Hayley Sermons offers a tidbit of local history and admires the flowers in her garden as her carer Emma Harris hangs dress after tea on the clothesline. The interaction is easy, comfortable and familiar.
Here I am is where the old sawmill used to be, so the soil here is really, really good.
But up against a housing crisis, staying on Tasmania's east coast hasn't been easy for Emma.
It's been, extremely stressful. It's not a nice feeling not having a home and not having stability and security. Like, I already had the thoughts, well, if I can't find anywhere to rent, then I would have to leave the area because I can't live in a tent forever. So that means I would not be able to be working with the clients that I'm working with.
After months of searching and a desperate social media call out, Emma and her sprightly pooch Gypsy will soon move in to a rental in Scamander. She's relieved, but doesn't think it should be this hard to secure housing in Australia.
So you've got like 10 people looking at one property and only one of these people are going to get it, and there's literally nothing else on the market.
Emma is one of many newcomers to Tasmania's Breakaday municipality. Its population grew by almost 10% in the 5 years to 2024, but housing hasn't kept pace. Demographer Lisa Denny says the population is projected to keep expanding, mostly because of people moving here from around Tasmania and Australia, but also because we're living longer.
Well, for Breakaday, it has a very ageing population. It has aged at quite a rapid rate, and that's been driven predominantly by older people moving to the area and younger people leaving it.
It's one of six Tasmanian councils where more than half the population is projected to be aged over 65 in about 15 to 20 years' time. But Dr. Denny doesn't think that will actually transpire.
Much older populations all will be demanding and needing a higher level of care and access to age-related services than is currently available in their local government area, which will either require them to move elsewhere or those local government areas will need to attract those people to provide those services.
How did we get here? Well, like most housing issues, the pandemic is in part to blame. Heidi Howe is a real estate agent in St Helens, the biggest town in the region.
So that's probably been, if you like, a byproduct of COVID, in that a lot of our investment property owners purchased them before COVID. So when the prices rose through COVID, they're like, I should be cashing in on this now, and they're actually making a return on their investment by selling in a higher market.
Buyers moved in and rental stock that had been around for years disappeared.
It's probably affecting our rental stock more than anything, in that our area doesn't have a lot of new building happening. So when there's that many people moving to an area, there's not enough houses to give everyone accommodation. The other thing that matters here is when investors are looking to buy a new investment property, they're looking at how much return they can get on their investment. So if you buy for $500,000, you want to get $500 a week in rent is the general rule of thumb. But because we're very much a blue-collar working area, the incomes here really cap perhaps how much people can afford to pay in rent. So we can't always reach that desired level of rent that an investor's looking for.
Heidi says people are also after stock that simply doesn't exist, like larger houses on the outskirts and modern smaller dwellings closer to the centre, suitable for downsizing. Dr. Denny says housing should look beyond just numbers.
We really need to start looking about the type of housing and the dwellings that people need at different ages and stages in their life. I think there's a real opportunity to look at what certain people might need that enables them to move out of their existing dwellings to something more appropriate.
Breaker Day Mayor Mick Tucker isn't surprised that the coastal charm and easy way of life are having a pull.
This is the Gold Coast of Tasmania. We live in the very best place in Australia, trust me. But the problem with that is we bring so many people here who actually want to make it their home.
But he says there's little councils can do to get shovels in the ground.
All the approvals under the sun doesn't actually build houses. The economic stimulus, which is required by state and federal government to incentivise developers to build houses, is what's really required.
He wants the state government to bring in an infrastructure contribution policy to stop developers holding off building because they're put off by costs of essentials like sewerage, water and power.
What we have at the moment, we have some developers who have bought a lot of land and they hope that the developer in front of them wants to build their units first so that those roads and the infrastructure has already been put in and then they can just tap into it and only have half the cost. If we have infrastructure contribution, everybody pays equally, and it's working in every other state of Australia.
The state government says it's considering its potential. In an effort to speed up builds, state, territory and federal governments have agreed to pause changes to the National Construction Code. The Commonwealth has also brought in build-to-rent reforms, policies that aren't without critics.
Tasmania reporter Beck Pridham with that story.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company here on Australia Wide. Let's stay with the issue of housing. It might be popular to hang the blame for much of the housing crisis on older generations, but no age group is immune from the rising cost of living. And when rent keeps going up and you're on a fixed income, there are tough decisions to make. Toowoomba resident Jan Howley never thought she would face homelessness, but at the age of 71, she had to think outside the box to keep a roof over her head. As she explained to Michael Bay, her decision has brought unexpected joy, but not before a lot of stress.
I went away for a weekend, came back, and there's an email from the estate agent saying that my lease renewal was coming up. Would I like to sign it? And I thought, yeah, sure. But in the meantime, my rent was going to increase. It was going up from $360 a week to $420 a week.
And if you're living on the edge, that is $60 that just isn't there.
It was impossible. I was fully expecting $10 to $20 increase. I was okay with that, just. I really didn't think of anything for about 5-10 minutes. I know I burst into tears. I thought, how could I do this? I didn't want to leave. What are my options? Panic. So I did the obvious things. Contacted the estate agent, asked if there was anything we could do, and they said no. So then I checked the government website for the rules, regulations. Could they do this to me? Was there anything I could do about it legally, you know, stop this? No. So I went on to realestate.com and checked it. I found 7 properties, and every single one of them, and I'm not kidding, every single one of those 7 properties had a little disclaimer on them saying that the rent was due to increase on the new lease. So I then put a Facebook post, and this saved the day, and asked for long-term rentals for a motorhome. One of the suggestions, and this is a godsend, was to share.
To share your house at the age of 71. Not a suggestion I think that everyone would take on board very well.
No.
How did it first strike you as an idea?
I thought, that's ridiculous. I scoffed at it. I haven't lived with anyone since my husband's passing. Where are they going to stay in my two-bedroom unit? But it dawned on me that this might be the solution. It was a viable solution if I could get over my own issues with it, the risks.
How did you get over those issues?
I think a couple of nights of soul searching and thought, yeah, I can do this. Because what choice do I have? I have a flatmate, Rebecca. I can say flatmate again. I haven't done that since I was 17. We met via that Facebook page. We met for dinner and then we had another dinner party and we really, you know, talked. I look at it this way, I've gained a real friend. We're gradually learning to live with each other, but I'm used to accommodating a husband of 50 plus years, so.
This was a solution for Rebecca as well.
As well. She didn't have a fixed address either. So she was looking for somewhere to call home, at least for more than a month.
There have to be some frustrations. A toilet flushing late at night, a TV show that wouldn't be your choice.
Okay, TV shows, yes, our tastes differ, but that's okay. We've found, I have some streaming services and we've found some shows we like together.
Do you find your evenings different to when you were living by yourself?
Yeah, I'm eating with someone at a table. And we're having conversations now. It's been 3 weeks now, and it's great. 2 months ago, I hadn't even ever thought of it. I thought being solo by myself was my life. Now it's not. Now I have another person to care for, to appreciate. We haven't had a fight yet, but and I hope we don't, but we're adults, so we'll talk it through.
Do you think this is better for you?
Much better. Yeah, I hope it's great for Rebecca, but it's certainly been good for me talking. At one stage, I thought I was going to lose my voice because I didn't use it very much. I've had enough of being alone 7 years. It's not easy. I was coping well, I thought. But I thought it hasn't been until the last couple of weeks. I've enjoyed getting up in the morning, looking forward to the day.
That 71-year-old Toowoomba resident, Jan Howley, who fought being priced out of her rental accommodation by becoming a flatmate.
ABC Australia Wide.
Let's head to Victoria now. Jockey Jamie Mellum has made history with 5-year-old gelding Half Yours winning the $10 million Melbourne Cup at Flemington. Mellum's win makes her the first female jockey to win both the Melbourne and Caulfield Cups to go with her win on Half Yours last month. And it delivers a big win for father-son training duo Tony and Calvin McAvoy, who were flying the Australian flag with the only homebred horse in the race. Here's how the race unfolded on ABC Radio with additional audio courtesy of the Nine Network.
300 metres to go. Goody Two Shoes for Ireland, led by a length and a quarter. Middle Earth and Half Yours is getting through. Goody Two Shoes with Half Yours challenging at the clock tower. Half Yours takes the lead from Goody Two Shoes. Middle Earth, River of Stars. Half Yours is coming clear for Jamie Carr for the Cups double. Half Yours, the history maker, won the Lexus Melbourne Cup by 3 lengths. Half Yours, the winner. Second, Goody Two Shoes. Third, Middle Earth from River of Stars, Torrens. Vauban behind those. Then came Absurd El Riffa. Then came Arapaho.
She is the new queen of the Australian turf. Jamie Mellum creates history for Tony and Calvin McAvoy. The 12th Caulfield Melbourne Cup double. And the first, of course, to be achieved by a woman in the saddle. Jamie Mellum.
Yeah, I've had an amazing year. Amazing year. Got married, had some really great days on the track, but nothing ever compares to this feeling right now I'm feeling.
That's Melbourne Cup winning jockey Jamie Mellum, who's become the second female jockey to win the Melbourne Cup, riding Half Yours to a famous victory at Flemington. The win comes 10 years after Michelle Payne's breakthrough triumph on Prince of Penzance and makes Mellum the first female jockey to complete the Caulfield Melbourne Cup double. ABC Sports' Matt Clinch spoke to Jamie's parents, John and Karen Carr, following the race.
Watching your daughter win a Melbourne Cup, what's it like?
Absolute. This is the pinnacle, the Melbourne Cup. No matter what, all the rest of these races, the Melbourne Cup is the Melbourne Cup. Wouldn't have been the same if she'd finished her career and not won a Melbourne Cup, so it is a huge one to tick off.
How are the nerves before the race?
Look, there's not... I actually really don't get that nervous anymore because it's really, it's so much, it's out of our hands, it's out of everything. It's, yeah, it is in the lap of the gods, really. You're out there, there's 23 other people want to win. As long as she gives it a great ride, we're always happy, and that was a perfect ride. So.
What about for you, Karen?
I'm just happy she finished safe and sound, for all the jockeys, really. But she did say this horse, particular horse, was such an easy ride, a good ride, and so I felt confident that she could, you know, give it her best.
And what a fortnight, Caulfield Cup, Melbourne Cup.
It's a big one, yeah. So, no, that's fantastic. Great spring, for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
The proud and relieved parents of Melbourne Cup-winning jockey Jamie Mellum. That's John and Karen Carr speaking to Matt Clinch from ABC Sport.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I didn't know Melbourne much. I knew where the racecourses were.
I'm making signs for the sleepy lizards.
Basically less eggs this year than what we would have expected.
The houses that are near the edge of the bush, they might encounter a snake up to 4 times a year, a death adder.
See how it goes.
On ABC Radio.
Let's head to Queensland now. Situated at the southern end of the Great Barrier Reef, Lady Elliot Island has been described by researchers as an island ark. So when a fiberglass boat ran aground on the island's reef earlier this year, a bespoke salvage team worked tirelessly to save the environment from irreparable harm from microplastics. Our reporter James Taylor has this story.
Scott Croxon starts every shift running the resort on Lady Elliot Island in the same way.
Normally, I get up before 5 a.m. and I like to try and wander over to the restaurant and grab my first cup of coffee. And it is my favourite time of the morning. That eastern side where the boat ended up is also where you watch the sun rise.
But on one cool August morning, Mr. Croxon's eyes were caught by something in the middle distance.
I was looking at some lights out there that seemed odd in the sense of how close it looked, but just the angle of the lights too, which made me just sort of question. I've got quite a large lens on my camera, so I managed to grab my camera, zoom out as far as I could, and when I took an up-close picture, that's when we sort of clicked and we could confirm that it definitely just was a vessel. The vessel wasn't sitting upright, it was on an angle. That's when I started escalating by making phone calls.
The alarm sounded on the morning of August 19, triggered a race against the clock, with a bespoke team of salvage experts assembled to save the precious marine ecosystem from irreparable damage. As the island custodian, Peter Gash explains, the first step was to see if anyone was still on the boat.
A couple of the crew went out on kayaks, climbed aboard, found the guy downstairs in his bunk. He was quite injured. He was semi-concussed. He had broken ribs and an injured foot.
A life flight rescue helicopter was dispatched from Bundaberg, which winched the skipper out of the boat to safety.
So they took him back to Bundaberg, which left us with the vessel sitting on the reef.
Mr. Gash made some calls to his counterparts at the Australian Maritime Safety Authority and the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, and the group started devising a plan to remove the yacht from the reef.
So we had numerous discussions. The decision was made to contract a company called CMG, Commercial Marine Group, in Brisbane.
We presented a project plan. All stakeholders need to have their fingerprints on so that they're all aligned.
Ray Crampton is the Chief Executive Officer of Commercial Marine Group. And his team's initial plan didn't take into account the pristine location of the shipwreck.
The intent was to cut in situ, so cut in place, and then bag all the components and transport to the island where it would be put into a skip bin and transported off the island. Peter presented with some concerns in relation to glass fibre or fibres from the vessel becoming detached and entering the water column.
Mr. Gash said the group's plan to chainsaw the boat into more manageable sections would release fiberglass microplastics that would do irreparable damage to marine life, particularly filter feeding organisms, including crustaceans and manta rays.
It's fiberglass boats, so fiberglass can break down into quite small pieces. Because a lot of times boats like that, they get the heavy bits out and they leave the rest of it to just degrade and fall apart. And of course, that's not good for the reef. It's not good for the wildlife.
Mr. Crampton and his team then went back to the drawing board and struck on the winning idea.
Basically decided to mobilise geotextile or geofabric, which is a type of fabric that they use for filtration of soils. We use it in our day-to-day operations for eliminating concrete from entering into a water column. This is quite a unique one. Geotextile is not typically used for this type of event. I can't think of anything else that would have been more suitable for trying to confine the fibres. The geotextile has a micron rating of 70 microns.
With a rating of 70 microns, the geotextile captures particles as small as 0.07 millimetres, roughly the width of a human hair. The Marine Park Authority gave the new plan the green light, and Mr. Gash, a qualified pilot, flew to Brisbane to pick up the geotextile, some CMG technicians, and inflatable airbags. The CMG team, with assistance from resort staff, wrapped up the boat in the geotextile and went to work on floating the yacht off the reef using a custom lightweight aluminium cradle or sled.
The vessel was prepped to be pulled off the reef. We positioned it, strapped it on, and then they pulled the sled off, pulled the boat off, and they took it away. It's kind of what happened, but that was a 10-day ordeal.
Mr. Gash was full of praise for the salvage team for achieving the brief with no lasting impact on the reef.
That's one of the first times that's ever been done. It was a collaborative effort of partners. We had a common thread of this is how we need to do it. We can't do it any way but the right way. We have to look after it properly.
That's custodian of Lady Elliot Island, Peter Gash, finishing that report from James Taylor. Let's head to the Northern Territory now. An 18-year-old Warramungu man from Tennant Creek, a town about 1,000 kilometres south of Darwin, whose work has led to a significant reduction in rates of youth reoffending, has been named the NT's Young Australian of the Year. Our reporter Lisa Herbert has more.
Described as a beacon of hope and resilience for young people in the Tennant Creek, Ali Kerung and Elliot communities, Jaden Dickinson was shocked by the win on Monday night.
It's meant a lot, actually. It's meant a lot. Now that I got winning the award, now I've got connections, I've got everybody that know me, now I can talk to everybody and everybody around Australia.
In his role as a Tennant Creek Mob Youth Diversion Officer, the teenager uplifts other young people by helping them address their trauma and overcome personal challenges to get on the right path. He's got no plans of stopping anytime soon.
My future plan is to change the community where I stay, change the young people's life there, just to let them know that they've got a second chance in life to live a better life, keeping them out of jail, community service, youth diversion. Kids, I pick them up 9 o'clock in the morning and I'll do 20 hours of community service with them. I sit down and have a talk with them about the life and the things what they did, and just tell them what they did was wrong and ask them what they did, is it right or wrong to do it? Most of the kids say, it was the wrong thing to do. So most of the kids are changing. To get back on track, find a job and live their life happiest and to enjoy their life.
And Jaden's work has won him a lot of local fans.
Favourite thing for me in Tennant is the kids there, they look up for me and I am the role model for them. They always say that they always wanted to be like me. And I'm just trying my best to teach him to be like me.
That's 18-year-old Jaden Dickinson, awarded for his work as a Tennant Creek Mob Youth Diversion Officer. Other winners on Monday night were volunteer paramedic Felix Ho, named as the 2026 Australian of the Year for the Northern Territory, Jenny Duggan, who was crowned the NT Senior Australian of the Year. She's known as the Town of Catherine's Rubbish Warrior. And the NT local hero is Catherine teacher Ron Green, who, among other things, continues to fight bushfires and attend vehicle crashes as a volunteer for the Northern Territory Fire and Rescue Service. And finally here on Australia Wide. Feral cats are a massive problem across Australia, even in very remote places like Truanna, Cape Barron Island in the Bass Strait. But there are people working hard to tackle the problem. Our reporter Louise Mylan headed to Cape Barron for this story. And just a warning, this story contains the name and voice of an Indigenous person who has died. It's used with the permission of her community.
Nothing.
It's been a week since June's caught a cat.
Very disappointing. It's deflating.
She's been out with her fellow ranger, Lindy, every morning, first thing.
Surely we're going to get something this week, June.
June and Lindy live on Truwana, Cape Barron Island, an Indigenous-run community of 80 or so people on a little island in the icy waters of Bass Strait, off the north coast of Tasmania. The Truwana rangers do all kinds of things to care for their land, everything from replanting kelp to spraying weeds with fungicides to trapping feral cats. When my colleague Morgan and I visit the island, June and Lindy pick us up every morning. We pile into the back seat of their ute armed with metal traps and tins of sardines.
Can you cross that trap out for me, old girl?
We rumble along with the radio playing, following Lindy's handwritten notes for the location of each trap.
We've got fire break to cemetery.
Yeah, you also got Tilts of Tower. Yeah.
At the moment we're going down to a place called Prickly Bottom. So this is what we call the other side, which goes down to Thunder and Lightning Bay.
That's a great name. The other side.
The other side. A bit like the corner.
Every time we pull up to inspect a trap, there's a hint of anticipation.
We got to get something.
Will the trap door be down with a seabird murdering feral cat waiting inside to be eradicated? Or will it be, disappointingly...
Up. Up. That's up. 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 Yep. She's up. That's a bummer. I think you two are a jinx on us. I know, we might have to go and just put a cat in there for us. Who's got a pet cat?
I do. My daughter might kill me though.
But for these women, this ritual isn't just about catching cats and managing their land.
Oh, good one, Lindy.
It's a moment to bond. The two women rangers in an all-male group, listening to music and chewing the fat about all the happenings on their remote island home. June's older than Lindy, and it's special for these women from two generations to be working together.
Yeah, this is our little thing.
Who celebrates more when you get one?
Oh, June, she squeals.
Do you squeal, June?
And I give the thumbs up. Oh, I get excited about cats, killing cats, I'm sorry, but I love cats. I absolutely love cats, but not feral cats.
It might seem an unusual passion, but June's full of surprises. She's a pool shark, a champion eight-ball player, and she's skilled at stringing necklaces of shells gathered from the island's beaches, something Indigenous women in this part of the world have been practicing for millennia. She's got plenty of stories about growing up on the island.
I think we had brush-tailed possums. I just remember having a pet brush-tail.
Oh, a pet one.
That we used to live up in the pine tree. So right on dusk, you'd hear this little scraping at the door, and it'd be our possum wanting to come in. And if you hadn't been to the house before, like if you were a new person there, he'd piss on you. But if you come back 6 months later, he'd remember and he wouldn't piss on you. It was like as if he knew you. And there must have been a glass of wine or something that was left sitting down the side of a couch. Well, the possum drank it and it was drunk for 3 days. I remember Mum having it like in the old stove we had, and she'd got it going, it was just warm, and she'd had it just sitting in there for 3 days. It took the sober up.
Oh my god. And before she was a ranger, she worked all kinds of jobs.
I started off working in a cray factory in WA, and then I come back and worked for Flinders Island Aboriginal Association. Then I went to Hobart and worked at the TAC. And then I decided to go to the university. So I went to the university and worked before there when it was only the old Aboriginal Education Unit. And then I went to Centrelink for 14 years.
And this work's so different to that kind of work, right? Being outside.
There was just nothing around when I was young like this.
Lindy loves spending time with this eight ball winning, shell stringing, cat catching extraordinaire.
I don't know. She's another woman and we get along good.
And just as our hopes dwindle that we'll catch a cat, something happens.
There's something in this.
Oh, I can hear something going. What have we got? We got a feral. We got one.
Yay!
My colleague Morgan takes a picture of the two of them with their cat in its trap.
My face is always serious.
They're standing on top of it, hands on hips, staring out into the distance like superheroes. Back in the ute, Bruce Springsteen's on the radio. There's a cat in the tray and the ladies are pumped.
Job done.
Yeah, yeah. One less feral cat on country.
Took over a week to get that cat.
I know.
Hard work.
Was it worth it?
Yes, it was. Definitely.
That's the late June and her fellow Truana Ranger, Lindy. That story was from Louise Mylan on Cape Barron in the Bass Strait. And that is Australia Wired for this Tuesday. My name's Alex Hyman. Thanks so much for your company. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.